Hi, this is Bill Endicke for the Streets.mn podcast, conversations about transportation, public space, and urban design in the Twin Cities. The podcast this week is the first of a series I've been wanting to do for a while, where I gather expatriates living in the Twin Cities to talk about their former homes. This episode is a group of three people who grew up in Detroit, Michigan, but now live in the Minneapolis-St. Paul area, and they sat down the other day with me to talk about what they miss or they don't miss about their home city. Detroit just declared bankruptcy this week, so it seemed like a good time to discuss what Detroit can teach us about our urban futures. We met at the Astor Cafe and had a great talk. Let me introduce the cast. For this podcast, I had the pleasure of talking with Beth Lorraine Bowman, a painter from St. Paul, Peter Schilling Jr., an author from St. Louis Park, Joe Mann, an economist from Minneapolis. They all had to say a lot of different things about the differences between Michigan and Minnesota, between Detroit and Minneapolis, and I think you'll find the conversation as interesting as I did. One thing's for sure, Michiganders love talking about Michigan. So enjoy the conversation. I'm here with Peter Schilling and Beth Lorraine Bowman. Beth, you're a painter from St. Paul, and Peter, you are a writer from St. Louis Park.
That is correct.
But really, you're both from Detroit.
I'm from Michigan, actually. I've lived in the Detroit area. But I'm from Upper Michigan and Saginaw.
Oh, Upper. Okay. And I was...
Upper Lower. Some unpleasant.
And I'm third generation born in Detroit. But I really wasn't mostly raised there.
That's one of the things I wanted to ask you about, which is that people who are from Detroit really aren't from Detroit, right? Because no one that was middle class remained there. That's one of the myths of Detroit. Is that true or false?
I would say that is true, but being a third generation person from Detroit, my grandmother is in her 90s, and she's part of the greatest generation, really at the height of the boom of Detroit during its glory time. And her family did live in city limits. And then in the classic Detroit story is my story, which is that my parents, boomers, fled Detroit. So my experience was in the suburbs. So I was actually raised in Troy, Michigan, which is upper middle class neighborhood, suburb of Detroit. And so my experience of Detroit was a suburban experience, much the same as any suburban experience. So I was always really curious because I would hear my parents tell horror stories of Detroit, and then I'd hear fantastic stories from my grandmother and my grandfather of, her taking the train in Detroit, her getting her graduate degree in inner city Detroit, her working at Hudson's department store in inner city Detroit, and her teaching. She was a public school teacher in Detroit, and so she saw it through the height to the low points to really, really violent times to race riots. And so I'd hear all these really fantastic and interesting stories from my grandmother. And so I've always been really curious because I'm sure that this all has shaped me and my outlook and how I view city life and suburban life. And I've always been really interested in arts and culture and urban issues. And I'm pretty sure it has to do with my upbringing of being technically from Detroit.
And Joe, we started without you, but it's not. I wasn't. I was just trying to be sensitive to people.
Yeah.
People's needs. The premise of this.
But
you are totally on time.
He was actually early, which is.
I was just early, and I just thought we. Whatever. It's my fault.
Fine.
It's not your fault.
Yeah.
It's all me. Anyway. Oh, it's not you, it's me. You probably heard that before.
I've heard that.
Yeah.
Commenting on my love life.
Oh, it's looking up these days.
Anyway.
Okay.
I thought this was about Detroit, damn it.
Motown.
Are you going to introduce him, or is he just going to be dope?
No, I want to introduce this idea of this podcast, and it's the first of many. It was the idea that I know a lot of cool people from Detroit in particular, and you are three of them. And so I was thinking, why are there so many cool people from Detroit living in Minneapolis or St. Paul?
The Twin expensive.
What's going on with that? Or St. Louis Park?
Metro.
The Metro. That's weird. But they're all... So I just wanted to get... The question I had was, what is... How do you look at it, the city differently, being from Detroit versus the people that grew up here, which is like me? And the myth of Minneapolis is often that everybody's from here, and I don't think that's true at all. So part of the idea of this is to debunk that, you know, by talking about, the variety of backgrounds that make up the Twin Cities. So that's the plan. And so I invited Peter... you're a writer. You wrote The End of Baseball. It's an awesome book about a myth, like a fictional book about the 1944
Philadelphia A's. If Bill Veeck had bought the team and gotten rid of all their white players and integrated baseball with an all-star team of Negro leaguers. That is that book.
And it's an awesome book.
And I'm writing a book right now about Mark Twain and the Mississippi River.
Oh, wow.
Oh, that's
great.
Really
cool. Yeah, that's very cool. And Joe, you're a writer, also an economist.
Yeah, I'm not really much of a writer anymore. I'm mostly an economist nowadays.
Yeah, and you work for the Minneapolis Federal Reserve.
I do, yes. So, mostly a regional economist, and it's a region that does not include Detroit.
No.
Yeah.
But, yeah. And then, okay, so that's the introductions. And Beth, your perspective was awesome. Joe, which part of Detroit are you from that's not actually Detroit?
I think we're all from parts of Detroit that are not actually from Detroit, probably. I'm from the suburbs. I actually went to high school in Bloomfield Hills, which is... maybe the wealthiest suburb of Detroit. It's not the most well-known one, which would be Grosse Pointe. I went to Losser High School, which is now closed. They joined the two high schools into one, but yeah. It's a very privileged suburb of Detroit, but I actually grew up on the border between Bloomfield Hills and Pontiac, which is like a little piece of Detroit that was slapped down in the middle of the wealthy suburbs. As the name might imply, it's another automotive manufacturing town. It's where they made Pontiacs. I grew up next to the Pontiac Truck and Coach bus factory. So a big contrast there between Pontiac and Bloomfield Hills. And that's part of my... I guess that's part of why I got interested in economics in the first place.
Uh-huh. Yeah. And can we just go around and say how long we've lived in the Twin Cities? And I'm not going to say that.
Let's start with that.
Okay, I've lived in the Twin Cities off and on since the 1990s.
Yeah.
Likewise, I moved to Twin Cities in fall of 1998 to go to college, and I've pretty much lived here ever since, except for a few stints here and there elsewhere.
And next year, my wife and I will have lived here for 20 years. Wow. Lived in 1994.
Great. So, with that said, I kind of asked you all a couple questions. Before you coming here, which is what just trying to get at the differences between here and Detroit. So what do you miss about it, and what do you not miss about it? That was the question.
I guess just speaking to what we talked about before this podcast, we were talking about Block E, and I guess for me, part of it is I miss, in kind of a broad sense, the grittiness of news. I mean, part of what you get in Detroit and in Michigan in general, it's good and bad. On one hand, I feel like the journalism was better there. The Free Press and the news kind of have collapsed, like a lot of newspapers. But the Star Tribune, everything seems very clean and very, I guess, I don't know if I want to say not dramatic. I mean, and that's sadly a reflection of a lot of the corruption and the horrible things that are happening in Michigan at any given time. But even with on NPR, you know, this notion that Block E is the saddest block in the upper Midwest. I mean, they would never say that in Detroit because there's literally thousands of those blocks in Detroit. There's thousands of those blocks in Flint. There's hundreds of those blocks in Saginaw, Lansing, Jackson, everywhere. Pontiac. I mean, you have those spread all the way across Benton Harbor, all the way across the state of Michigan. So you don't have that, you know, people are constantly looking for solutions. I think there is an optimism within the cynicism that a lot of Michiganders have. And I miss that. I mean, I really like the optimism that's here in the Twin Cities, but sometimes I think it's a little happy-go-lucky, and that gets old at times.
Yeah, I think a lot of what I miss about Detroit are more things that I miss from growing up, like, you know, just sort of aesthetics of, you know, the architecture, air in southeastern Michigan has kind of a different smell. It's kind of hard to explain.
Try to explain that, Joel.
It's really rich, especially in the summertime. It's very humid, clean. Even in pretty industrial parts of Detroit, you know, unless you're like right next to a sewage treatment factory or something like
or the Rouge River
plant or the Rouge River, the air is just, you know, it just has a different smell in the air. But you know, those are mostly kind of wistful things about growing up there that I kind of miss. I think culturally there's a bit of a difference. I think that that you know this kind of Northern European passive aggression that people have here in the Twin Cities is sort of not really present in Detroit. It's much more of a Catholic culture, I guess I would say. You know, kind of blue collar Catholic. Like people will tell you what they think. Italians, Eastern Europeans, Southern Europeans.
There's everything in
Detroit.
That's the great thing about Detroit.
Yeah. Another thing I actually miss about Detroit is really good Middle Eastern food.
Yeah.
You don't really have.
Yeah,
no, high five.
Yes. Yeah.
Oh, my God.
Yeah. You can't see this, but I'm high-fiving.
Coney Islands.
Like what? I don't even know
one
what you're talking
would
about.
Say, I mean, don't you think that there's a really great food community here in the Twin Cities.
Yeah, absolutely.
But it's very upscale and it's very hipster. Mm-hmm. And there's, like, every suburb and the city of Detroit, there are dozens of these like mid-range restaurants that are fantastic. Greek, mm-hmm. Middle Eastern, just grocery stores. I mean, donut shops, for God's sake.
Yeah,
I can't believe,
there's
a ton of donut shops here, and they're all these, like, ooh, I've got this bourbon maple glazed bacon donut. It's kind
of
like, I just
donuts,
want a nutty
with
donut.
A slice of bacon,
you know, that's all I want.
Yeah, I think, like, here, for example, if somebody opens a proper Jewish deli, first of all, it's not a proper Jewish deli. It's some guy trying to open a mock proper Jewish deli.
Yes, exactly.
And it'll be, you know, probably a good 20% price higher than it should be.
Yes.
And they can get away with that because it's, like, sort of the only game in town.
It's a novelty.
You know?
Right.
But they certainly don't have the kind of cutting-edge, high-end foodie thing. I mean, there's some of that going on there, but it's not as present as it is here. A lot of what I wouldn't even say I miss about Detroit, because it wasn't there when I was growing up, is a lot of the sense of kind of optimism and entrepreneurialism that you see there. There's a real... I mean, whenever I go back, and I'm going back this week and looking forward to it,
yeah, you're packing tonight to go tomorrow.
I am going to be packing tonight for my Thanksgiving trip home, yes.
Wow, exciting.
Your family's still there.
Yeah, my mom and dad are still there, and yeah. I mean, a lot of the things
Did you just move to Florida, Beth?
Everyone fled to Palm Beach.
Is that right?
It was the great exodus.
Troy. You're from Troy, okay.
I was born in third generation, born in Detroit.
Okay.
But then... baby boomers all moved to the suburbs, mm-hmm. to Troy.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
Yeah.
So yeah, I mean, I just there's this kind of wild sense of possibility there right now, and I think, you know, it's easy to overplay it because it's still, you know, the city's problems are still so huge and seemingly insurmountable that like a few kind of crazy pipe dreamers and, you know, hipster artists and stuff like that aren't really gonna like change things overnight. But there is a really kind of a palpable sense of optimism.
What's the palpable sense of, oh,
wanting
a beer.
A beer.
Oh, you don't have one. Okay.
No, we do. You just don't want it.
You don't want it.
Apparently,
it's
very watered down.
Yeah.
It's like a bug
voice.
What's
So, yeah, what else do you have on tap? Do I see a tap next here?
Do you have anything from Michigan?
Do you have any bells?
Bells.
Yeah.
Oh man.
Okay. I like a little bit of everything. What do you have for Belgian beers?
I have one Belgian. It's called the New Belgian.
I'll have one of those. sounds magical.
Thank you.
All right. Michigan has a really great homebrew scene, or a craft brewing scene, which
definitely awesome.
Miss as well.
Better than Minneapolis, Minnesota, etc.
You know, I hate to make comparisons.
But that's the whole point of coming here.
I think this is a comparison show.
That one feels to me like it's just different. I mean,
different.
It really does. It's like the difference between the Detroit Tigers and the Minnesota Twins.
Oh,
it's
you know, I do want to talk about that
it's
also.
But it's, I don't know. I mean, it feels the Michigan homebrew, or not homebrew, but the microbrew craft beer thing. It seems very vibrant.
Mm-hmm.
And it's just one of the wonderful things that's emerging from Michigan.
Definitely.
It's surprising.
Greek food.
But everything. My God, the Greek food, the Middle Eastern food, the Jewish food. It's all, I mean, you get it all.
Is it cheap? Mostly pretty, I mean, not cheap, but affordable. You know?
Yeah.
Affordable.
There's
it's
competition
affordable.
Is the thing.
So we're talking about restaurants that are in the kind of areas that you're from, though.
Everywhere.
You can go to some of the worst neighborhoods in Detroit, and there will be a Coney Island. Like,
yeah, but
you know.
Also, the thing that's shocking to me is it's almost not shocking to me that you can go into a bad section of Detroit and find a good restaurant. It's shocking to me that you can go into like the Maplewoods and the Eden Prairies and like in strip malls. There's like, oh, here's a little Greek restaurant, and it is amazing. It's just some immigrant family just like open it. You look outside, it says, well, the sign literally says in yellow letters restaurant, and you go inside and there's this Greek food that's better than any Greek food you'd have here in the Twin Cities, and it's just a moderately priced
family,
like a Pearson's restaurant, except with the most incredible Greek food.
I think Peter just put his finger on what I would point to as being a big difference between the Twin Cities Metro and the Detroit Metro, which is that there's actually a big difference between the suburbs. A lot of the suburbs here, with the exception of maybe a few entering suburbs that are kind of older, are pretty homogenous in terms of architecture. Every strip mall is kind of the same. They're all chain restaurants and stuff like that. But what you just pointed to is something that is very true. You can go to, they still look the same outwardly. It's still strip malls with big parking lots and stuff like that. But the businesses in them, there are actually a lot more kind of independent family-owned businesses. And I think that's an artifact of the fact that, you know, the white flight in Detroit and the urban decay was so dramatic there.
And it was early.
It was early.
Yeah. And you have large swaths of Detroit that are suburbs that are, you know, basically populated by who used to live on the east side of Detroit 50 years ago. And so they're still blue-collar, ethnic European enclaves that just kind of picked up and moved to the other side of 8 Mile. You know, and so it's a little bit, you know, I think the suburbs there are different. The other thing that they have that they really don't have here is, like, hip suburbs. Like,
I don't even know what you're talking about.
Royal Oak, Ferndale, Michigan, and then those are the two most prominent ones.
And, of course, they're right next
describe
to...
Describe a hip suburb. I don't even understand what you're
saying. It's like, imagine a suburban version of Uptown, you know?
Yeah, or
like a less cool version of Uptown, basically. But, you know, it's a sort of, in the Detroit area, it's like the only game in town, right?
Yeah.
Yeah.
So if you can imagine, like, Royal Oak is a suburb that I think it abuts right up next, right near the Detroit Zoo, and it abuts up next to 8 Mile Road.
Mm-hmm.
And so you've got this, like, downtown that has all these, like, used vintage clothing stores, kind of, you know, restaurants like you'd find in Uptown. And I don't know if the housing is inexpensive anymore, but it was a place where people that were like, oh, I want to be in Detroit, but I don't really want to be in Detroit.
Yeah.
You know, and so they live in Royal Oak because it's a cool place to go. And you're 5 minutes from Tiger Stadium and downtown and all that if you wanted to live there. I lived in Royal Oak for a little while.
Beth, is that where the art scene is?
I don't know. I've been part of the art.
I think there's a lot of art galleries in Ferndale and Royal Oak, but a lot of the artists themselves are on like the Cass Corridor. And some of the other neighborhoods actually in Detroit. Palmer Park is still a pretty lively arts community there, I think.
I have to admit, I've only been... Go ahead.
I'm working on a new series of paintings. It's going to be 6 8-foot, or huge, 8-foot paintings of Detroit. And so I'm working with the Detroit Historical Society.
Nice.
And I'm trying to get aerial maps of where my grandmother worked and went to school, and I'm going to show like an aerial map of the shrinkage on these huge, huge things, right, that I'm working on. So this is part of, I don't know about the art scene there. I know very little. I'm like in the dark because I am third generation there, part of this sort of mass exodus. I know more about West Palm Beach gated communities than I know.
That's too bad. I've been to West Palm Beach.
Which is another weird thing. And actually, there's a lot of people from Detroit there, including in a strip mall, the most delicious Greek diner.
All right,
family-owned diner, and they're all from Detroit.
Yeah.
So I get to interact with more people in Detroit in Palm Beach. But
they have Jet's Pizza there, too.
Yeah, it's great. So that's part of my whole new plan for this new series, and then I hope to go to Detroit and like really be informed and just kind of immerse myself and try to figure out the parts of my history that are missing as someone that was kind of part of Detroit's history, like the missing history, you know? I mean, so I can't speak to the art scene there today.
That's
part of my investigation. That's my question.
You know? Yeah, that's great.
You know, Bill, there was another half to your question, which is what don't we miss about Detroit?
Well, I have to ask that, too.
Get around to that. I don't know if I want to... Either you want to take
it. Like you want to stab it that
one,
Joe.
You go ahead first.
I mean, I think that, you know, one thing that's even more dramatic in Detroit, even though we just got done talking about the kind of how the suburbs are different and there's hip suburbs there, there's a really stark urban-suburban divide there that it's not any way comparable to the Twin Cities. I mean, there's a lot of just straight-up hatred there, and a lot of it is rooted in racism.
Oh, yes.
You know, you have people whose families fled Detroit a generation ago, and they're still bitter about it. That's something I don't miss. I think that's one of its major dysfunctions is the kind of political economy, political geography, maybe of the Detroit area is really prevents kind of the sort of regional cooperation that you have here with the Met Council and some of the other bodies. You can say what you want about them, but at least there's like a kind of a planning board for the metro area as a whole, and you just don't have that.
Yeah, the race map of there's a great these racial dot maps of America, each city in the country, mm-hmm. and it shows like it has different colors for different kind of ethnicities,
mm-hmm.
And the Detroit one, the 8 Mile line, is still so stark in the 2010 census. Like nothing much is. One of the things that's changed, I was reading about it, is that African-American community is moving out to the suburbs at a fairly high rate.
Yeah, in the last couple of decades, there's actually been black flight from Detroit.
Yeah.
A lot of affluent blacks.
But that line is still really palpable, you know, 50 years after it was created or whatever.
Yeah, it's crazy the way that Detroit is balkanized. Because the thing that's interesting to me is it's not just, you know, black in Detroit and white in the suburbs. I mean, it's certainly that, but it's also like Dearborn is Middle Easterns, and
it's,
you know,
like
there's
the
like
the largest Middle Eastern population outside of the Middle East,
right? Mm-hmm. And there's like for even in its heyday, you still had like Hamtramck is like where the Poles lived, and there was like, you know, I mean, you know, there's enclaves like Bloomfield Hills has a lot of Jews, and it's just very much, you know, certainly there's mixing of these things, but it's so divided. Even to this day, that it creates this kind of like strange atmosphere. It's like, why, you know? And to me, the stark contrast between suburb and Detroit is not more. It's so clear when you go walk between like Detroit and Grosse Pointe. I mean, it's just like Grosse Pointe is right next to Detroit, and I mean, you can walk like 10 blocks and you're in like one of the worst sections of Detroit, and then all of a sudden you're in Grosse Pointe, which is one of the wealthiest cities in America. By extension in the world. I mean, and it's insane. That's insanity. I mean, that's...
So you think
that's
when we have a racially polarized city here, but it's not the same, it doesn't feel the same, or...
Because the racial polarization is within the city itself. Whereas Detroit, there's more polarization between the suburbs and the city. You know, the city of Detroit is something like 85% or more black.
It's more even, I think.
I think it might be higher than that now. I mean, actually, one thing that happened in the last census is that the Hispanic communities continued growing. And that's kind of changed the dynamic a little bit. You know, whereas within Minneapolis, there's this whole achievement gap, and you have, you know, sort of north side, south side divide. The city is really segregated, but again, it's like, you know, just like Chicago or any other big city where the segregation is within the city. Whereas Detroit, it's like you mentioned, 8 Mile Road. That's it.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, and I don't miss that. I mean,
there's definitely race and class issues in Detroit. I mean, there's all around the world. I mean, there's all across America.
But
the thing that I think is slightly different on the positive side, I mean, I'm white. I'm from a middle or upper middle class white family. And I grew up, and my mother's best friend was African American, and my grandmother's best friends were all Jewish. And so I grew up seeing that, and I really hesitate. I just really don't think a lot of middle class white girls in Wayzata saw their mothers having lunch with African American friends.
That's true.
So, and I think, and I don't know what the explanation, you know, maybe it's Detroit's had more of a mix for a longer period of time. And then also there was a really great article in the New York Times about how, you know, of course there's conflict and problems with all these things, but that with the auto industry, what it did is it helped to create a black middle class.
Mm-hmm.
And they were really badly hit when it collapsed. And so I think that's part of it because, you know, my mother and my grandmother's friends were middle class educated black women or other ethnic minorities. And so I grew up seeing that. And so when I moved here, you know, I remember I asked my mom, I'm like, where's the black people? I mean, there was just, they weren't here, and I didn't get it. So I think that, I mean, it's a smaller metro, though, too. I mean, I think, too, the media makes you think that, like, Detroit has shrank to, like, three city blocks or something. And then you look at it, and it's like, it's still double the size of Minneapolis.
It's still 750,000 people.
Yeah, it's like the same size as Boston or something, right? Yeah. I mean,
three times the geographic area.
Right.
But yeah.
Yeah, I mean, like, but the head count, you know? Yeah. So I think that's something, you know, that people forget, too. I mean, I forget it, so.
Yeah.
But it was good for me as... just as a person to grow up and see that, you know, see a really nice variety of relationships, where here I feel like that doesn't really happen very much.
Yeah,
I don't know.
The absence of I think that's another big difference, really, between the Twin Cities and a lot of other large cities, not just between the Twin Cities and
Detroit,
is the absence of a black middle class here. There's hardly any black middle class at all. And I think that actually makes the white racism here that much more acute and kind of ignorant, frankly. Growing up where I grew up, I don't automatically look at a young black male and assume he's a criminal. Because I had a lot of black friends growing up, you know, and I think that that's, whereas I think that a lot of people that I know here probably do make that assumption.
And the people that I know that are black middle class here are not from here. They're from Chicago or either coast or something.
Detroit.
Yeah. Right. They're not like born and bred here, because it seems like if you're black here, you are born in one of two areas and you stay there. And mm-hmm. so that's part of that achievement gap that you're talking about. Mm-hmm. And it's really too bad. I mean, I've worked in arts and nonprofit sector, and you would think that would be a more open-minded and inclusive kind of working environment.
You would hope so.
And I have never worked with one, and he was from Denver. So, I mean, it's just...
That's another
It's
thing.
Amazing. I think it's a real loss to this region that's lacking.
Now, that being said, I think that a lot of... The Detroit area is still really segregated, and I think a lot of... a lot of white kids growing up in the Detroit suburbs are pretty much unaware of the black middle class, because they've sort of just learned these stereotypes from their parents and their peers.
Yes.
I think when I was growing up, most of my peers just assumed all of Detroit was a big ghetto.
Mm-hmm. And you hear that. I mean, you get people that are like, in the suburbs, it's been my wife is from Bloomfield Hills, and, you know, you hear a lot of, like, there's not the use of the term, you know, like, the N-word, obviously, but black or African-American. It's just like, in Detroit, they blank do this. Or they do that in Detroit. And Detroit becomes this thing that's like, it's kind of the secret word for the bad things that black people do. It's like, if there's something bad in Detroit, it's really, that's what black people do. And that's, so there is that strain of kind of intense racism there. I mean, I would say that the racism here seems very passive-aggressive, kind of in the same way that Minnesota's. But I guess I would say that, for me, that's one of the things that I don't miss about Michigan, is I don't miss that racism. There's a tremendous amount of anger, I think, in Michigan. There's so much animosity from people about the way the cities have kind of collapsed. It's racial, but it's also just... You know, my dad worked in a factory in Saginaw.
There's so many forces behind
that. Yeah. Well, there's tons of forces. But it happens everywhere.
But,
I mean, Detroit is like, it's like if Michigan were a pond, Detroit is the big stone that hit the water and kind of reverberated through the state. I mean, you've got Flint is Detroit in half, and Saginaw is Detroit by a fourth, and Jackson is Detroit by like a sixth.
Lansing.
I mean, and Lansing. And all these
Malcolm
things,
X
I mean,
is from Lansing.
Right, and actually that's a perfect example kind of some of the... There's even a passive-aggressive racism in Lansing. I mean, there's a Martin Luther King Jr. Street in Lansing, which is great, except that, as my dad used to point out, he's like, it's too bad they didn't honor Malcolm X, whose father was murdered by white supremacists, on the streets of Lansing.
Yep.
But of course they wouldn't have a Malcolm X Street, because he's from there, and his aggression was towards people from the north. So, you know, in Michigan, as here, we can, like, honor Martin Luther King, but we're not going to honor Malcolm X. is just a little too...
I didn't know he was from Michigan at all.
He was, yeah.
Yeah, I don't know if he was born... I think his parents ended up in the Lansing area as part of the kind of the diaspora looking for work in the north. Like, I think he was born in the south somewhere,
Nebraska,
but I think he, like...
or something.
Yeah, I think he lived, like, a year or two wherever. But he went to high school in Mason, which is the county seat of the county where Lansing is headquartered. And that was... at the start of Malcolm X, as a matter of fact, he talks about that's where the whole thing with I want to be a lawyer, oh, you should push a broom.
Yep.
And then he ends up going to New York and ends up becoming Malcolm X. Yeah.
What do you guys think of media representations of Detroit in general?
I think it's really striking how much it's actually changed in the last few years. I actually think that, you know, and count me as somebody who has always been very cynical about this. I think that it's actually, like, Detroit's national image has gotten more positive in the last few years. And I don't know if it's just because of the rest of the country feeling sorry for Detroit. Like, and it's like, oh, geez, everybody's always bagging on Detroit. Like, let's cut them a break, you know? But, you know, I think that I used to, and this not, maybe not necessarily a comment on the media, but when I used to tell people here that I was, you know, that I was from Detroit, they'd say, oh, I'm so sorry.
Yes.
You know, although people still say that.
And now a lot of people still say that, but I would say 50% of them, and maybe it has to do with my sociocultural milieu, but I think about 50% of them probably say to me, oh, I hear there's a lot of really interesting stuff going on in Detroit.
You're right, that does happen.
Detroit looks really cool, you know?
I get to encounter the weirdest thing that happened to me a month ago was when I was at Whole Foods in Uptown wearing my Tigers hat, and the black guy behind the deli counter was like, what is that D for? Because it was an old 70s hat.
What
and
is
I was
that
like,
D for?
And I was like, that's Detroit. And he's like, are you from there? I'm sorry. And I was like, and I was like, dude, man, Detroit's awesome.
Yeah.
And so we talked about it for a little while. He's like, I thought that was like Duke or something. And I was like, sigh. No.
Yeah, not Duke.
That's Detroit. But don't you guys, like, what do you guys think is so, like, the reason... the thing that baffles me is all this attention about Detroit, like, in the last 5 years. Like, why? Detroit was not in good shape in 1995, and now it's in bad shape. As we were talking before this podcast began, I'm 45 years old, and my entire conscious life, Detroit has been a problem. Flint has been a problem. Mm-hmm. Saginaw has been a problem. I mean, the downtowns were dead. The 70s is when the big three started to collapse. By the 80s, a lot of these factories had been shut down, even before... NAFTA.
Yeah.
And then since NAFTA, which I think was 93, 94.
Yeah.
I mean, it's just that these factories are just completely going away. So lately, Detroit has become a thing. And I don't... I mean, to me, what connects it was, like, I started hearing more about Detroit in 2011 when, unfortunately... the Detroit Tigers and the Detroit Lions were starting to play well. And I say unfortunately because it disgusts me when people are like, look, Detroit's coming back because the Detroit Tigers and their millionaires are playing baseball well.
I'm pretty sure the Lions aren't doing well still. I mean,
after
last yesterday's game.
NFC North, buddy.
But that game yesterday, I don't know. I mean, they kind of have a way of screwing themselves.
Oh, yeah,
how
do the Vikings do?
I'm not here to debate this.
This is a tangent, but this is something that really annoys me. Whenever I end up in a conversation with hater-ass Minnesota sports fans, and
I'm a Packers fan, for the record.
And so, for example, the season, the NFL season opener this year, when the Lions beat the Vikings, and people are like, "Oh well, Detroit's a shithole." I'm like, "Wait, I thought we were talking about professional sports. Like, what does Detroit's economic plight have to do with their quality of their NFL football team?
Do they deserve it?"
Well, that was
like
the
you
very
have nothing
weird,
else, right?
There was like classy, not classy. I was at the game where the Tigers clinched the Central Division here at Target Field.
That was
and
there too.
I'm wearing my vintage Mark Fidrich 1976 jersey and walking in. All these Twins fans are like, hey man, good job, congratulations, blah, blah, blah. Except for the one drunk guy that was yelling out, bankrupt! And he was just shouting, screaming that as the Tigers are having their little celebration on the field. So I was like, I don't know. That doesn't. I don't know. I feel like it kind of goes both ways. On one hand, it's like, you know, yeah, I mean, Detroit, our economic plight doesn't have anything to do with these sports teams. But conversely, the fact that the Tigers and the Lions are doing well has nothing to do with Detroit.
Oh, yeah. I hate it when the
people are constantly pointing to it, like, yeah, well, you know, Mike Ilitch let the big
three announcers
have
always try and whip up this drama, like, this city needs this right now.
The
They've
New
been
Orleans
through so
Saints
much.
Winning, though, might have a little bit more, like, impact on the actual city of New Orleans, but maybe not.
I don't know. Really? I mean, I'm not seeing it. And I'm certainly not seeing you know, these baseball players driving in their tinted SUVs into the stadium, driving from their gated communities way the hell out into Detroit, play their game, then they scoot out. I mean, virtually, I don't think virtually anyone who lives in the city of Detroit is going to either Red Wings, Tigers, or Lions.
It's like the Atlanta Braves just built a stadium. I don't want to talk about baseball, but they just built a stadium that's outside of Atlanta in the suburbs where all their fans are.
Yes,
they're about to, right? And, you know, so it's the same kind of phenomenon could be in Detroit.
But that's when the reason I brought that up was because that's when it felt to me that there was the thing Detroit was starting to be talked about like 2 or 3 years ago, and it felt like when I first started noticing, I was like, I saw it on, we were watching NBC Nightly News, and it was like, the Lions are doing well, the Tigers. And then we'd show all these people in Detroit. Yeah, Detroit's coming back. They would have the requisite, like, you know, it was seriously. I mean, I don't mean to be so cynical, but it was like, there was the conversation with the smiling black guy who lives and was like, yeah, man, my Tigers are coming back, and I'm so happy because Detroit's coming back. And I was like, what is this? There is so much unemployment. There's so much. I'm like, the city is just. So many
problems. He
suddenly
got a pension. Everything was coming to him.
And then I started seeing things like the New York Times had articles about what's that barbecue? There's a barbecue restaurant called
Slows.
Slows. Yeah. And there was a feature article about it in the New York Times. I'm like, yeah, all the barbecue joints that have been run by guys who have been living in Detroit their whole life. Not living in the Detroit area. They live in Detroit their whole life. And they have these barbecue restaurants that are probably 1,000 times better than the Slows thing. And this is the restaurant because it's a white guy who came back and built this beautiful restaurant. And the article is like, people from the suburbs are finally coming into the city. And it's like, that's important. But there's all sorts of stories in the city. And there's not just these. That was the biggest problem I had with Detropia. It was that it's great that you have people coming into the city. But hipsters having their crazy little parade in the middle of the street is not all of Detroit. I mean, Detroit is so much more. All these little cities.
So let's talk about Detropia.
Yeah,
Beth, what did you think of that film?
I thought it was fascinating and captivating, but I couldn't help but feel like I kept thinking of my grandmother and in her 90s, thinking like, and this is what we're, you know, about the term ruin porn.
Mm-hmm.
Like, you know, it was really, what about the glory? You know, what about the people's stories that during the glory, I mean, it was Silicon Valley of the world, you know, for a while. It was innovation and entrepreneurship and really fruitful for a lot of people. And so, I mean, I would hear stories about my parents and my grandparents going to music and jazz clubs and, you know, so I'd hear all these really great stories. And I didn't really see that in that. I mean, that wasn't really the point. The point was to show the ruin porn. So it's shown as, like, ruined porn, like, look at all the decay. Or else it's shown as, look, it's a big blank slate for hipsters to come in from Brooklyn and buy up a building for a dollar and turn it into, like, a crazy art installation loft.
Mm-hmm.
That sounds great.
Yeah, I think that sounds great.
I mean,
awesome.
I'm being a little extreme there, but...
No, I just want to do that right now.
Yeah, you can have this for a dollar. And then you can, like, you know, make a garden, an urban garden and stuff like that, and ride your bicycle. But, which is great. Those things are all really nice to do. But it just kind of felt, and then it made me actually, this is kind of why I wanted to do a new series about Detroit in my own personal work, because I would just want to learn more about it. And I want to, you know, I talk to my grandparents a lot. And when things happen in the news with Detroit, which is all the time, I call them and I say, oh my gosh, they're selling the art museums, all their work on Sotheby's. What do you think? You know, to my grandparents. And my grandma's like really sad. She's like, this really makes me sad, you know? And my parents had their first dates at the museum.
How do you feel about the Diego Rivera?
I love those. They're beautiful.
Oh, it's amazing.
They're amazing.
What are they going to do with it?
What are they going to do?
Like carve it out of the wall? I mean, it's not
like sell sections of plaster? I mean, or whatever, you know, yeah.
I'm an optimist about that. I don't think it's going to happen.
Yeah, no.
But we'll see.
But, yeah, it's. I mean, it's too bad. But
maybe Justin Verlander will buy it all.
Yeah.
So that's my... What did you guys think about the documentary?
So, okay, I don't really want to talk about Detropia. It was, you know, it was... I thought it was... great cinematography.
Right.
I thought it was a well-made movie.
Yeah.
I think a lot of the criticisms of it were this kind of like, oh, you know, hipsters can't save Detroit. And I like watched the movie and I'm like, actually, I don't see a lot of hipsters in
there.
This
was this
movie.
One scene that was a little irksome, but the rest of it was not really
about
the
guy with the mustache or whatever. But it's like, I think there's a bigger thing. This actually gets back to things I don't miss about Detroit. And there's one sort of unfortunate aspect of, and it's not unique to Detroit, but anywhere where you have economic deprivation, you get a lot of, you know, for lack of a better term, I'm going to say haters, right? People get successful, and then everybody looks at them with suspicion, right? And
what,
I think
so. What people so, get successful?
Well, I'm speaking in generalities here, but here's an example of what I mean. So one thing that is somewhat well known about Detroit in the last, you know, 30 years or so is techno music started in Detroit, right? And this is this, you know, you have these guys who started, you know, DJing and making electronic music back in the 80s, and then it kind of swept Europe and, like, led to the whole birth of rave culture and all that kind of stuff. And these guys have become, you know, really high-profile kind of superstars over pretty much overseas, and they make hundreds of thousands of dollars a year just going and DJing at clubs, mega clubs in Europe and Japan and places like that.
Did you read the New Yorker article about that?
I didn't know. And you know, and a lot of them are kind of like kind of unknown at home. And you know, you have these guys like Derek May as an example, who's sort of one of the innovators of techno, and it's like he's like tried to like stick with Detroit and keep his business there and everything. And a lot of these guys who've ended up getting successful making music. And actually, outside of tech, Jack White is another example, right, from the White Stripes. He hightailed it to Nashville because he got sick of all of the kind of backbiting and, you know, as soon as somebody gets paid, like, everybody kind of wants a piece of it. And if they can't get a piece of it, it's like, well, fuck you. Like, you know, you didn't deserve it anyway. You're not even from here, you know. And, like, there's this kind of... And so this feeds back into Detropia.
Yeah,
this feeds back into Detropia because I think that, you know, what I think is comical to me is when I talk to people from back home and they start bitching about hipsters and gentrification, and I'm like, shut the fuck up. Detroit needs gentrification. Like, okay, yeah, I understand people in Chicago, people in, like, in here in Minneapolis.
San Francisco,
like,
or Manhattan.
You don't know gentrification yet. You know, like, come to me when people start actually getting priced out of their neighborhoods. And, you know, and...
Because of the difference is that no one... If gentrification happens, it's not even gentrification because it's not like... These are empty... No one's living in these places.
It's not
a real estate problem. It's not as though people are going to be moving out. Oh, well, I've lived in this house forever. I'm being priced out of it. I mean, they're going to... Jesus, how much? 60% of the buildings in Detroit are abandoned?
So that's what I mean. I think a lot of the anti-gentrification sentiment I've encountered in Detroit is actually just aesthetic distaste for hipsters. And it's just like, you people aren't from here.
Justified.
You came here from Williamsburg and blah, blah, blah.
No one says that about Bob Seger, man.
Right.
They love the Bob.
Yeah, you gotta love Bob Seger. Yeah.
It's not always hipsters. There's a nice documentary from, I think, the 90s about Columbus, Ohio. And about a gay neighborhood kind of taking over a black neighborhood. And it's so to me, it's mostly about identity politics standing in for economic inequality.
Absolutely.
Right?
Yeah.
That's how I read the gentrification issue. And, you know, you can see that black-white along University Avenue in St. Paul. That argument is about decades and generations of economic inequality, and that kind of being expressed through a conversation about a transit project or whatever.
Right.
Mm-hmm.
You know?
I mean, I gotta say, I mean, I haven't encountered people that are pissed off about gentrification in Detroit just because I haven't encountered them. But I mean, I gotta give anyone that moves into Detroit a lot of credit because to me, that's braver than anything I would do.
I wouldn't live
in Detroit because I mean, the problem I'm having with gentrification, like say Manhattan and New York City, is that you're getting like these wonderful stores that have been around for generations that are being. You know, they're thriving. They're making their owners money. They're paying their rent on time, and all of a sudden, their rent quadruples. Well, in Detroit, you know, if you're going to say I'm this artist who wants to live in Detroit, you're also willing to, you know, deal with all the. I mean, the problems in Detroit are so incredible that it's like, I mean, you got to tip your hat to anyone, black, white, hipster, not hipster, blue collar, who's willing to put up with all those problems without really having this. Center that attracts them. I mean, at least if you go to Manhattan, if you go to any part of New York City, there's a thing that's there that is just that attracts people from all over the planet.
Yeah.
That thing is not in Detroit. I mean, it's blown out across. You know, the things that make Detroit exciting are all over the place. I mean, it's one of the one thing I don't miss is the fact that it feels like there's a half an hour drive to everything.
Yeah.
The one really good restaurant like that LA. I go to, it's a half an hour away. If, you know, I'm involved with the Trilon Microcinema here in Minneapolis. If there's one of those, I certainly wouldn't be living 15 minutes away from it, as I am even in St. Louis Park.
Yeah, and you're not
right
even
now.
That close
it. Would be
to
like,
it. Yeah.
Shoo, I'd be driving clear over into another set of Detroit. I'd be taking all these different freeways that have all their potholes.
There are so many freeways in Detroit, by the way. I just have
so
to
many
say
freeways.
That.
There's a hell of a freeway system, man.
Yeah.
Named after people.
Named after Walter P. Reuther and
yep, all sorts of people.
It's a freeway of love, Aretha Franklin.
Really?
That's right.
So, can you just, everyone say your favorite movie about Detroit or take place in Detroit?
It's a good one.
Anybody?
I'm going to skip that. I'm going to say
oh, come on. You can
that...
do the top three if you want, because I know you're a movie nerd.
Yeah, I mean...
There are really no good movies about Detroit that I've
No,
I mean, there's
movies,
not.
No.
Everyone, I mean, a lot of people are going to be like, yo, RoboCop is awesome, and I think RoboCop is awesome, RoboCop
dude.
Is crap. I just saw it. We just showed it at the... Well, they want to make a RoboCop statue in Detroit.
They do.
You know. I don't know.
You
I don't
like RoboCop, Peter. No, it's okay.
Not,
it's okay.
There's not that many... There's not a lot of good... There's not even
like
really
Roger
that many...
And me?
That's not about Detroit. That's about
see, I think we're talking about fictional movies, though. We're not talking about that.
But that's Flint anyway. But.
Anything.
So, okay, two things. Beverly Hills Cop. It's not actually, I mean, it is actually, I mean, actual Foley is from Detroit.
Yeah.
And, like, and you get some great shots of Detroit in the 80s, which is awesome.
Yep.
So I'll put in for that. If we're going to talk about, I mean, we talked about Detropia documentaries, there's a better one than Detropia called Beyond the Motor City. And it's really a comprehensive... story of the what happened in Detroit, kind of the autopsy, what went on here, and it focuses a lot on what we were just talking about—the fact that the city is so car-centric, and basically they let the big three redesign the infrastructure of the city, and this awesome freeway system that they built just became a conduit for people to flee, and for you know. I think, you know, this is another thing that I think is a misconception that people have about Detroit. When I talk to people from here, they think that all of the Detroit metro area is poor and abandoned. And they don't realize that there's still this, it still is like a metro area of 4.5 to 5 million people. And there's a lot of wealth there, actually.
Well,
it's just all in the suburbs.
There, yeah.
And there's like an industrial, there's a you know, a residential development industrial complex there. You know, and it just keeps the sprawl, just keeps sprawling further and further out.
This is a fancy mall. I mean, my mom used to take me school shopping. I mean, we'd go to Saks and Neiman Marcus. You couldn't do that here in the 80s.
Not anymore. You can't either.
Now you can.
Yeah.
Now, but I mean, like, you really couldn't do that.
And like 12 Oaks or something like that, isn't it?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Somerset.
Oaks, Somerset
you
Mall.
Live by.
Somerset,
yeah. Is the fancy one.
Right.
You've all been to Somerset Mall?
Unfortunately.
Just laughing.
Actually,
I got followed by security there when I was a kid because I was dressed grimy and they thought I was going to steal stuff.
I have a fun.
Did you?
And I'm white.
Did you steal anything?
No, I didn't steal anything.
I have a funny style tip from my 90-year-old Detroit grandmother. So I was it was fall, summertime, and we were shopping in Palm Beach, and we were in some dumb mall, and my grandma pointed to this really sparkly, super tacky thing, and she said, "Beth, do you like this?" And I said, "No, Grandma, I don't like this, you know." And then she turned to the salesperson and said, "She's from Minneapolis. She doesn't know anything about style."
Nice.
Hey, there you go. Bam. Bam, Grandma.
It seems like, from what I've learned about Detroit, and I have to admit that I've been to Tiger State in the old one, and I drove through Detroit the last time I went there. It was just for a friend's wedding, and he was getting married in Livonia.
Yeah.
Which is a suburb.
One of the whitest cities in America.
One of the whitest cities in America.
Like 97% white.
Anyway, so I drove around Livonia a lot, and I also took one trip through the city, but I didn't really have a lot of time. At weddings, you don't really. I was the best man at the wedding, and I was kind of booked the whole time. So I didn't really get a chance to go to the Heidelberg Project, for example, where I wanted to go. But Belle Isle seems to me like one of the coolest things about the city of Detroit. And
I love Belle
Isle.
Did
any of you have a story about that place? Have y'all been there? I'm sure.
Plenty of Belle Isle stories. When I was a kid, my dad used to take me golfing there on weekends. My dad and I would either go on Saturdays or Sundays. We'd either go fishing or golfing pretty much every other weekend. And
so you went golfing on the island. Mm-hmm. The city of Detroit playing one of the whitest sports.
Except this is the great thing about the municipal course at Belle Isle. It's just a little par 3 course, and it's a 9-holer. Most of the people playing there are black. You know, it's a municipal course, and again, it's this. There's a black middle class in Detroit. Yeah. Palmer Woods, which is an 18-hole course in the north end of Detroit. You know, my dad used to play there back in the 70s. He played with Smokey Robinson and Berry Gordy.
That's awesome.
That's where they used to. He just like ran into them there. It's like, oh yeah, I'll let this guy play. You know, but we found a golf tee that had a name, T. Giacalone, on it, who is. He's kind of the boss of the Detroit Mafia at the time. And my dad was like, "Oh, you got to keep this." Like,
did you keep it?
This is Tony Giacalone's golfing tee. Like, he's the godfather, you know. Yeah, I kept it. I don't know what happened to it, actually, unfortunately. So we used to go to, you know, Belle Isle is great because, you know, Detroit's a big city. Friday afternoon, kids from all over the city go to Belle Isle to go hang out and cruise. And it's like, it's where you go if you're like 17 years old and you're trying to meet girls from other schools. You know, you go, you roll out to Belle Isle, and it's just like a, it's just this great party scene.
How do you get there? You drive there?
There's a bridge.
Yeah.
There's a big, it's called the MacArthur Causeway. Not Causeway, it's just MacArthur Bridge. Yeah.
And now they're trying to, billionaires are trying to buy it and turn it into a separate country. You've heard about that, right?
Yeah.
No, I haven't heard
about that. That's a weird little sci-fi Randian fantasy.
There's this thing where this guy has this, I think I have the book at home somewhere, where this guy wants to buy Belle Isle and sell shares of it. It would be kind of like Bahrain, basically, mm-hmm. where it would be this, it wouldn't be a part of America anymore. Mm-hmm. And the unit of currency would be the rand, which I thought was amusing. And
it sounds really
if
close
you see
to...
The guy, I don't know what the guy does who wrote this little, it's a novel, quote unquote, where it's like, here's this image of Belle Isle as this, and it shows these like skyscrapers rising out of Belle Isle and everything like that. And his author photo shows him in like a monk's robe with like a hood, and he's like, he's a prophet. He's the capitalist prophet. Yeah, it is a little quirky here in Detroit. Everyone's got their ideas for how to save Detroit, and that's merely one of them.
That's actually one of the things that was on. I was looking over my list of topics that I wanted to cover, and actually, this is the easiest interview I've ever done because all of you really want to talk about this, which is maybe a Detroit thing. Just wait till I get to like the Kansas City conversation. And I have to drag things out of the people's, you know.
Kansas City is great.
Is Kansas City great?
Oh, I've been there. I had a great time.
The food at the stadium is terrible, but otherwise it's good.
Well, okay. I guess it was this idea of I read this good article. They talked about three different modes of describing Detroit. One was the Detroit metonym. So metonym means like standing in for another thing. So an example would be Wall Street. We say Wall Street when we really mean to say the financial industries, all of them, right? And Detroit is our metonym or our like symbol for the auto industry in general, right? So we say we bailed out Detroit. We're really saying we bailed out the big three auto companies. So I'm kind of curious about... if your family worked in the auto industry, what the relationship to the auto industry was, or Fordism, have you heard this term?
Yeah.
It describes that there's this pact between the worker and the employer, right? That we need to pay people enough so that they can afford to buy our product, you know? And that was like Henry Ford's sort of ethos, at least in the 20s to the 50s. And then I read a great book that I know we've talked about, Joe, Sugru's book about Detroit.
Yeah.
Origins
of the
beer,
Urban Crisis.
Yeah, I do. Yeah, she's gonna come over.
Okay.
The Origins of the
Urban
Crisis.
I need to
find
one better than the one I just had.
Oh,
it
wasn't
terrible.
Very good.
Yeah.
It's not Belgian enough. Yeah, you gotta read your menu.
Hardly Belgian at all. There's like they don't have a beer list. It's killing me.
No, because they have shitty, crappy beer. I mean, all they're talking about is. Yeah. I mean, Surly's fine, but
Surly is fine. I mean,
it's just
not my
fine.
It's a beer that I admire more
but,
than I enjoy.
So, how big? How much do we blame the auto industry, or what are your feelings about the auto industry? As it caused Detroit to occur in the first place,
it
like
caused
this
me
is
me to occur. I would have never been born. My father.
Well, a lot of us were born in the backseat of a car, right?
Or conceived.
Conceived,
at least.
I should say. Yeah.
Well, I don't know the details of that part. Of
well,
the
not
process.
Me in particular, but I'm just saying. I think a lot of America would agree with you.
Well, no, my father's side. So he, you know, they lived. My father's family lived 200 years in the same county in Philadelphia, in Pennsylvania, right? 200 years. And his father was an engineer and moved to Detroit for the automotive industry, and he was an engineer. And that's when my father met my mother, and they fell in love and, you know, had me and my sister, you know. So, I mean, the other day, just after watching the Detropia documentary, I realized if it wasn't for the auto industry,
I never would have been made because there's no way in hell that my father's family would have left that damn county in Pennsylvania, you know?
And a lot of people moved to Detroit for the jobs in the auto industry,
right.
including mm-hmm. it was one of the only places on the planet Earth where a black person could go and get a decent wage. I mean, 10 times what you'd make as a sharecropper in Mississippi or whatever.
Right, yeah. It was still awful.
Yeah,
it was still awful conditions.
You got the crappiest job in the factory, right? Like the painting room. In Sugru, they talk about what kind of jobs African-Americans could get in Henry Ford's factory in River Rouge. Right, and it's always the worst labor. Janitors, yes. And painting room, which is like you inhale chemicals all day long.
And there are huge housing problems for African Americans in Detroit. I mean, that's what led to the 43 riots, actually. Yeah. The 1940, the worst in terms of property damage and loss of life, the worst riot in America in 20th century was the 1943 riots in Detroit. And they were
partially, it was a white race riot.
It started as a white race
riot. It was on
riot,
Belle Isle.
But a lot of it had to do with, you know, just the anger that people had. I mean, it began because of fights on Belle Isle.
Yeah.
But then it just exploded.
Even back then, young people were going out trying to jock ladies.
Yeah, it seems like a universal, always happening. But I guess my question was about the relationship to the auto industry and, like, how you feel about it, about that industrial connection and that life, you know?
So my own personal connection's not that strong, aside from the fact that actually my mom worked for Chrysler, and that's how I paid for college. But
that's kind of a big deal.
What I mean is I don't have roots that go back. My mom was a nurse, and at some point she became an occupational nurse at a Chrysler factory, and you know, it's union, and it's a skilled trade job, so it pays really well. I mean, and that was what, you know, very much made it possible for me to move to Minneapolis to go to college.
Thanks, Mom.
Ironically enough. My dad's from New York, actually. He's from Queens, and he ended up in Detroit because he sort of got sent there for work, long story short. My mom's parents her dad didn't work in the auto industry. He worked in the railroad industry, oddly enough, and kind of hated the auto industry because it was putting the railroads out of, trucking was putting the railroads out of business, yeah. Led him to an early grave, actually. So, but I think that the city's relationship with the auto industry, you know, I think what's, you know, and getting back to this sort of narratives of Detroit's decline, I think one of the really underlooked aspects of it is that Detroit was a boom town. Its population went from about 350,000 people in 1900 to 1.5 million people in 1920. It was like the fastest growing settlement in human history, and that was, all, of course, entirely due to the auto industry.
It was the Guangzhou or Shenzhen of its time.
Yeah, and I think that is, that kind of growth pattern is not sustainable. And Detroit should be a cautionary tale for, it's too late for Vegas. It's too late for Las Vegas, but maybe Williston, North Dakota. I mean, but it was like, you know, it was a boom town, just like you see in an oil boom town like Williston, but it was on the biggest scale ever. Right, and it wasn't based on a natural resource boom. There wasn't mining there. They were mining poor people's labor. You know, once the unions got entrenched and the poor people labor kind of ran out, you know, and I'm not getting into that whole blaming unions for Detroit's downfall, but like all of a sudden the mine of poor labor ran out, and I think that's, you know, that's, I think, a really underlooked aspect. So people always, you know, put it in terms of, well, the auto industry was really strong, and then it eventually declined due to foreign competition and stuff like that. And I think
that's not
just
the story.
Really that boomtown aspect is really overlooked.
Yeah, and I think the labor constraints, because that's what the Sugru book just tells you, is that people was, the auto industry was already automating all of its assembly processes as early as the 1953 is when,
right after World War II.
It's not all.
No, it's not all automated.
I mean, automation had part of it, but I mean, there was. I mean, to me, it feels like there was a perfect storm of just incompetence and greed. There was that boomtown aspect of it, but like, because my dad worked, he was a union steward at Eaton Manufacturing in Saginaw, which assembled steering gear components for General Motors. And in Saginaw, there were a lot of people. For some reason, Saginaw was like the steering gear capital of
that's on their sign.
There's Saginaw steering gear, which was General Motors and Eaton Manufacturing.
I never steer a gear without thinking of Saginaw.
See, I know. Who doesn't, right? But I remember my dad talking, even in the 70s, that it was a mistake that Detroit wasn't trying to attract. I mean, we have manufacturing in Ohio for Hondas and Toyota. I mean, the car that you can get that has the most American labor is a Honda. I mean, that's because it's made here. Because otherwise, they would get taxed a lot. They used to be able to get taxed a lot more, and now they moved a lot of their manufacturing here. The foreign auto companies like Toyota and Honda, and Michigan could have got those, but they chose not to because there was that racial element to it. You know, people didn't want these Japanese cars getting in the way of the big three, and that was a mistake. But there was also the fact that I think the unions were corrupt, and I think the people that ran the corporations were corrupt. I mean, I do think that there's no way to have sustained what they had before, but there's certainly, it didn't have to collapse to the extent that it did. I mean, NAFTA kind of, you know, now how many of these cars are even built? I don't think there is an American car other than some trucks that are built in America anymore. I mean, I know Chrysler's not, and their ads are all like, show the city of Detroit and like, oh,
hey, what do you guys think of those ads, the M&M ads?
Oh, man.
They're imported from Detroit?
Yeah.
They're not imported. I mean, there's nothing.
That's what the slogan is, though. Is
yeah, awesome. But they're not, yeah. I mean, there was an ad during the 2011 playoffs that had, it was amusing to me because it had Bobby Bland's Ain't No Love in the Heart of the City, which I thought was amusing because it's like, yeah, okay, you're talking about Detroit and there's not even a city to have love come from. But, you know, you've got that Chrysler 300, which is mostly manufactured in China and Mexico. Mm-hmm. And, you know, they're like, well, you know, we build cars with integrity. Well, for starters, a Chrysler 300 is a piece of crap. I mean, it's an awful car.
And it's ugly.
And, you know, I remember my father talking about how we need to make, you know, American car companies. One of the other things that was hurting the American car companies in the 70s was that they were crap. They were awful cars.
Well, I show that I add in my urban geography class, and people find it very inspiring. I guess it's a good ad agency that made that, but yeah, I don't know.
It kind of tugs on your nostalgia or heartstrings a little bit,
but it's true that Michiganders. That's one of the things that is another thing I don't miss is this blind fealty to the big three. I mean, the big three has really fucked over Detroit so badly, and Michigan in general.
Yeah, and
they're
no
still
loyalty
just like,
to you.
Must buy American cars. But they're not even made here anymore. I mean, it's just, it's insane. I mean, it's like, why are you so
tied up
with it? I mean, it doesn't make any sense.
Yeah, that was one of the things that I actually found really depressing about the movie Detropia. I tried to end on this happy note of like, oh, things are coming back, and well, there's been a recovery in the auto industry and stuff like that. And it's like, what I thought was really great about the depression I shouldn't say great, but what I thought was like maybe one positive side effect of the depression that Michigan went through for the last decade was that it finally broke the back of that single-minded reliance on the auto industry.
Boosterism kind of mentality.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. And I think that, and also disabuse people of this notion that, like, we're going to come back eventually. If we just, like, get people to start buying American again, like, things are just going to go back to the way they used to be in Detroit. But,
kind of stuck in
know.
That nostalgia, huh?
Yeah.
What did you guys see the Anthony Bourdain episode?
Yes.
You did?
Yeah. I thought it was pretty good.
I haven't seen that one, but it was very controversial because I guess, did he only go to like white restaurants?
No, he didn't actually.
No? Okay.
He did a really
I haven't
good
seen
job
it. I just,
of, like,
I saw that it was controversial for some reason. Not a
My problem with that was that, you know, like the cool part of it to me was when he went to that little barbecue shack.
Yeah,
and that
I was just
going
to say. Yep.
And he went to like a little, what do they call them, pop-up restaurant. Those were really awesome. But too much of the like half of the episode was him like wandering around with that Fox News reporter. I don't remember that guy's name.
Charlie LaDuff. I like that
Charlie
guy.
LaDuff. I like that guy too.
Yeah.
But I don't want to hear Anthony Bourdain talk about the problems. Yeah. If he wants to talk about it in the first 5 minutes, that's fine. And then start talking about food because he can't go into the depth of it in an hour. He can't. He's not someone who knows what the fuck he's talking about.
No,
he doesn't know. He doesn't know anything about the city of Detroit, and he admits that. But he's just like wandering through and.
It's like
he also talks too much. It's like, would you shut up and let these barbecue
people... Shut up and
people...
tell me how to braise spare ribs. That's what people are paying you for.
I want to hear the
Nobody
barbecue
gives a
woman.
Shit about your opinions on political economy.
I want to hear the firemen talking about their cooking. It's a cooking show. I want to hear about the cuisine of Detroit. I don't want to hear about, like... I don't want you standing looking plaintively over the ruins of Detroit from the fifth floor of this abandoned building. It's like...
Yeah, and he did this...
I don't need to see enough... I've seen so much of that.
He did this kind of tongue-in-cheek, like, oh... Everyone in Detroit hates ruined porn.
And so we hate to do that, but yeah, I mean, rune porn's really cliche, but check out all these awesome ruins, you know? But like, we're not, okay, so we're gonna go ahead and indulge in that because it's what you want to see.
Can I admit that I love rune porn?
Oh, I fucking love it too.
Well, yeah, and I gotta say, to me, what you were saying about Michiganders complaining about hipsters, I'm the same way about ruins. You can't, to pretend that doesn't exist in Detroit is insane. It'd be like going to Chernobyl and being like, I'm just talking with a guy here. It's Chernobyl. I don't know what's going on. It's like, no, you need to show the trees growing up through these homes.
Yeah.
You need to show that there's a lot. Like, some of the ruin porn, I don't understand. Like, you know, like they'll show like a library. Look at all these books on the floor, and they're growing up with mold. Like, who the fuck is taking the time to hurl books all over the floors of these buildings? I mean, you look at some of these, like the book depository. There's this amazing shot of like, it seems like acres of books decaying and moldy with things growing up through them. It's like, who hurled books all over the floor? It would take like considerable effort.
That's a lot of sweat
to have done that. I don't understand. Like some of the
people have time on their hands. I would imagine.
I don't understand some of the ruins. So it's fascinating.
I'm just saying though, like it's not just those things. There's other layers to the story. You know, like but well, it's easy to go straight to the ruined porn
because
it's visually captivating. You know, it's visually stunning, you know?
Yeah.
I mean, so two things. Number one, just to get into that kind of haterism, I have a lot of friends that I've done a fair amount of urban exploring with who now bitch to me about rune porn. It's like, oh, I can't believe all these Dutch photographers coming here, photojournalists from Europe to document our... We're so sick of that stuff. I'm like, shut up. You love it. Like you're just, like, jealous that other people caught on to the shit that you're into already, right? You know? But there is a better criticism that I read of the rune porn, that makes a lot of sense, which is in none of it do you see people.
Well, right?
It gives you the impression that this is
a
whole city just full of ruins, and it ignores the bigger story, which is that this is a place where people still live. And it's not just cool old buildings that have been left behind to rot. It's also people who've been left behind. Who are still trying to eke out a living and are suffering.
Yep.
And you're not telling that story, the real human tragedy of it.
And see, that's what, to
that's
me,
a better criticism.
That's the biggest thing. Like, that is the one element of Detropia I really liked was following around that guy who owned the bar who used to be a teacher.
Yeah.
But
I like that guy too.
I would love to see
story.
2 hours of a documentary that had no one who had, I used to live in the suburbs, but I moved back to start my pop-up. I want to see 2 hours of, I have lived here my whole life. My family has lived here my whole life. It's going to be...
You should see Beyond the Motor City, man.
I should see it. But, I mean, I almost feel as though you're getting into that, like, if I did this documentary, it would only have black people in it, and I need to have some balance somehow. And it's like, no, that just show people that have lived, you know, because that's what we're... As you just said, this is what we're missing. We're seeing there are people... You get all the ruin porn you needed just by shooting on the streets where these people live, you know, the people who live
in
Detroit, because
there's thousands of homeless people in Detroit, which is interesting because there's a lot of abandoned houses there.
Yeah.
Right?
It's crazy.
I mean, it's not a lack of housing that causes the homeless problem there.
That doesn't make any sense.
It's an unaddressed need. Yeah. Lots of people who have mental illness that are lacking treatment, right?
Right.
Lots of people who have substance abuse problems.
Did Reagan like get rid of a lot of like institutions and facilities for mental illness?
Yeah, and that's a long story.
I mean,
that, you're absolutely right.
I don't really know much.
Absolutely right. And it actually goes back.
I mean,
farther
Reagan, our greatest president.
Anyway,
our most handsome.
But you're right. There's a lot of structural causes for homelessness.
Yeah.
But I actually we're kind of going long.
Yeah.
And you've been so wonderful.
We have.
All of you.
It's true.
All of you.
It's because we're from Michigan.
It's because you are from
Michigan.
I'm going to get, you know,
we
I want to get one word
right
in.
Hand and show
no,
where we...
I want to go around and have you all say something. One, but I don't know what your word is. First, I want to ask Peter what these books are that you brought with you.
Well, I always have to make a shout out for my favorite poet, Philip Levine. If you ever want to, I feel like if you ever want to understand kind of the soul of the city and Michigan, you should read Philip Levine. You can get his collected works. The older stuff is hard to find. A Walk with Tom Jefferson is my favorite book of his. And they're just really amazing stories about living a blue-collar life in the city. They're wonderful. And the other one is a book called The Corner, which is about Tiger Stadium. And it typifies to me, the Detroit Free Press wrote this and another book about Detroit, and it typifies that gritty journalism that I was talking about. This book is like, there's articles in here about, oh, how wonderful Tiger Stadium was, and I feel that way. There's an article by one of their black columnists who's like, this place was racist, and I can't wait until this thing is just blown off the face of the earth.
And it's happened. And, so.
Well, and it's happened, but you would never get, like, even if the Metrodome were a good place, you wouldn't... Whatever book would be there to commemorate it here, and in a lot of places, you'd have people just talking about, oh, it's so warm and wonderful. There'd be the usual
There's
baseball
There's
going
to be a lot of eulogies to the Metrodome in the next year.
There might be. There might not be. Yeah, I'm sure a lot of people would just be like, yeah, I'll write one. You should. Yeah. But I feel like there's that type of... I feel like one of the strengths of Michiganders is I feel like we both acknowledge our problems and we kind of celebrate them and we love... the ugly as well as the beautiful. We're not just willing to say, like, you know, we're willing to say this book, I think, typifies Tiger Stadium was a complex place. Everything in Michigan is complex. That's the bottom line, and that's what I want about it.
That's great. Beth, so here are the questions for all of you. What should someone from the Twin Cities going to Detroit do? One thing. And then B, what can the Twin Cities learn from Detroit?
How to play pinochle.
Okay.
Euchre, man. Euchre.
No one will teach me. I don't know. I haven't learned. It's a really a regional
Euchre?
Part. Yeah. Pinochle's like a regional card game. Yeah. And my family plays it. It's cutthroat. They play it in Palm Beach now, but, you know, they used to play it in Michigan. And I really wanted to learn how to play, but I was told my window for learning pinochle has closed.
Oh, dear.
So that's I would sad. Love to learn how to play pinochle, but it's apparently very difficult, and you really have to be born and bred in Michigan to play it. I would just say, like, I don't know. I'm going to find out. You know what I mean? Yeah. That's part of my, like, own kind of investigation into my family history about Detroit. It's a very polar history, the stories I've heard. So that's why I just now feels like a good time to investigate it.
Well, I'm glad we could talk about it before you go.
Yeah, and then I might have some more information later on. Yeah. And it'll be reflected, I think, visually in this new painting series I'm doing, which I'm really excited about.
And what's your website?
BethBowman.com.
Okay. Cool.
Thanks.
How about you, Joe?
Two things. So what should Twin Citizens do in Detroit, and what can we learn from Detroit?
Yeah.
So number one, what you should do in Detroit is get out on a bike. I think there's a lot of people who like riding bicycles here. Bill, I think that you're one of those.
I am.
And this is something that I've gotten into. I mean, I used to do it a little bit when I was a kid, actually, against the advice of my parents. But as an adult, I've really gotten into exploring the city on a bike, and it's actually a really great place to bike around because you can cover a lot of ground. You have this city that was designed for three times as many people as currently live there, and so thus you have big, wide avenues.
8-foot
and
bike lanes, no matter where you go.
And it's not a dedicated bike lane. And the other thing that I think that I wanted to say is that that an overlooked aspect of Detroit is Detroiters are really nice. Yeah. The city has this reputation of being this dangerous, violent place. But like everywhere I've gone in that city, and I mean, you think of this as being a car-centric city, and people tell you ride on the sidewalk, jerk. Like, no, people are like thrilled to see a couple of young white dudes riding around on a bike and people give you directions, ask you what the hell you're doing there and like, you know, and get your story. And it's like people like go out of their way to help you. And there's this sense of like everybody wants to make sure you have a good time in Detroit because they want to overcome that image of it being a dangerous, scary place. They actually like want to make you feel at home. It's this wonderful amalgamation of like, you know, Southern hospitality and, blue collar extroversion that, you know.
It's very extroverted.
Yeah, it's a very extroverted culture. Yeah, people are real. People will say hi to you, stranger on the street, you know. So that's actually something that people should do, I think, is get out and ride a bike in the city. And what we can learn from Detroit is that large scale, publicly subsidized entertainment complexes are a really poor model for urban redevelopment. There's a lot of examples of that in Detroit.
What about monorails? How do you feel about those?
Yeah, monorail. You make an argument for monorails. I kind of have a little bit of love for the People Mover, but we'll leave that aside for the moment. I mean, if you're the Twin Cities and you're saying, "Gee, should we invest a few hundred million dollars in a new stadium for one of our sports franchises?"
Just to pick something out of thin air.
Or should we learn from Detroit's example?
example and maybe try and mitigate some of the racial and economic disparities in educational attainment and look at what ended up costing Detroit long term, I think it's pretty clear where you should invest that money. And I think that's something that we really learned.
That was one of the things that was on my list and we didn't really get to was the failed urban renewal efforts of Detroit. You know, because there's probably a long list that we could talk about. Yeah. So,
oh, they've built some beautiful stadiums there, man.
Yeah, they have beautiful stadiums and they got a lot of different casinos and monorails and just you name it, they did it.
I love the Renaissance Center, man.
How about you, Peter? What's your one thing to do and one lesson for the Twin Cities?
Well, I guess I would say that for me, if you don't know someone in the Detroit area who can take you around to the great restaurants, to me, the best place to look at people and the best place to understand the soul of a city is in its restaurants. And there are a number of guidebooks. Don't go to a place like Slo's. It may be great. I've never been there. But, like, find the Coney Islands. Find the little barbecue joints, you know. If you know, go to the Middle Eastern restaurants in Dearborn. Go to the restaurants in Detroit, and you're gonna see
the Bucharest Cafe.
You're gonna see the people who live there, and they're gonna be serving you food, and you can have conversations there, and you can eat, which is always a wonderful thing. And that to me is just every city has its restaurants, and in Michigan, one of the things I love about those mid-scale restaurants that we were talking about earlier is that it's just such a wonderful strata of people. And even if you don't converse with them, just looking around is just, it's such a delight. And so that's one of the things that's the one thing I would recommend people to do. You got to eat when you go anywhere.
Yeah, that's true.
You need to go to these middling restaurants. In terms of what, you know, I don't know. I honestly don't know what people can learn from the city of Detroit because I feel like things have gotten so out of proportion there that it becomes difficult to look at it in a way that would actually help the Twin Cities. I mean, one of the things that I love about the Twin Cities is that I feel like when things do kind of, I don't know if you want to say gentrify, but when they do improve, they seem like there's, outside of Block E, it seems like they're fairly well thought out, especially in contrast with Michigan. I mean, you know, Auto World and Flint, my God. You know, I mean, there's so many things from Saginaw to Flint to Detroit where I've seen these developments. It's just like, this is just a way for someone to siphon money off. And so, and I don't think, I'm not seeing that happening here. The problems that we have in terms of like, oh my God, we got to get great bike lanes and do all these things. My God, if they ever did that in Detroit, I mean, we're like 100 years from great bicycling, making that a great bicycling.
They built a mile and a half rail corridor bike path there, and people think it's like the second coming of Christ.
Right. So it's like, I guess, nothing. I mean, I don't know. Like, my gut instinct is to say Detroit should look to the Twin Cities.
Yeah, but this isn't utopia. I'm just curious what we can learn from.
It's not utopia, but it's also not detropia. I mean, it's like I don't know what. Okay, Detroit.
Just to be more outgoing or something
like
that. Right,
Detroit,
Peter?
Has like, there's like a million failures. So what are the? Yeah. So one thing is stop being so goddamn passive aggressive and learn how to drive and learn how to tell people what you really think.
Yeah,
just
we
like
can't
Detroiters.
Anymore. Just tell
and come on, make it real. There's no. And the other thing is there's no beans in Coney Island, dog. I'm just telling you. There's no beans in Coney Island.
I mean, like a deli,
a real Jewish deli. You know, there's literally no kosher delis anywhere in the Twin Cities. If you're an Orthodox Jew living in the Twin Cities, you have no restaurant you can eat. I'm just saying, that's horrible. My dentist tells
Cecil's?
Me that.
Not Cecil's?
Nope.
No.
Nope. There's none. Okay. It doesn't exist. So
I won't invite my friends from the Upper West Side.
Yeah, as you shouldn't.
They wouldn't come anyway.
See, there you go.
I'll tell you where you could get some solid corned beef.
Well, we're any last words? We're gonna wrap it up. Thanks, you guys. You are just as great as I imagined you would be.
Go Tigers!
Go Tigers!
Thanks for listening to the Streets.mn podcast. Like I said, I want to do a few more of these with people from Milwaukee, Kansas City, Portland, San Francisco, New York, Texas, places like this around the country to even Canadians, I think, to talk about the differences between their cities and our city and what we can learn from that difference. And I think it'd be a lot of fun. So that's kind of the goal with this project. Meanwhile, if you have any feedback or ideas, you can comment on Streets.mn, on Twitter at StreetsMN, or you can email me at blindicky@gmail.com. So long from the Astor Cafe in St. Anthony, Maine.